Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. For the past few months, my nephew and I have been exchanging emails about his significant other's dog, Buster. And this past week, I got an email from Seth in which he asked me a question that I hear from my clients that caused me to think what I consider possibly great thoughts. But before I get into Seth's question, I want to mention that I have a very soft spot for Seth, and this soft spot grew when my father died. My father was laid out in a funeral home in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that was typical of the genre. Its decor consisted of a cross somewhere between a palace in Versailles and Monticello. And Dad's casket was open, and perched on the back of the open lid was the biggest fake fern I have ever seen. During the viewing, my mother, who was confined to a wheelchair and legally blind and had a sense of the dramatic that marked her entire life, would periodically fling herself out of the wheelchair and into the casket on top of my father. When this happened, the lid of the casket and that fern would just vibrate horrendously. And I would reach in and grab my mother, convinced that the lid of the casket was going to come down and decapitate her, or else she would be squashed by that huge fern. At the same time, Seth would launch himself. Out of my peripheral vision, I could see this tall, skinny guy in a dark suit literally fly through the air and grab the back of that casket. So I would drag Mom out of there and put her back in her wheelchair and get her calmed down, and Seth would vanish. And the funeral director would bring out a screen either from the Versailles or the Monticello era, put it up in front of the casket, call in makeup, and they would touch up Dad. After the second or third time this happened, the funeral director took pity on us and told us that the fern was securely attached to the lid of the coffin, and the lid of the coffin was firmly attached to the wall, so we didn't have to worry about Mom being decapitated or squashed by the fern. That made a special bond between me and Seth. I mean, our timing was really, really good on this. I'm sure if there had been a market for such services, we would have been highly successful. Consequently, when he emailed me about this little cockapoo, Buster, I naturally wanted to help. Buster is what we in the trade sometimes refer to as an armpit dog. They're cute little fuzzballs who start off their lives spending a lot of time being carried around and treated like little babies. And then when they reach adulthood, the whole responsibility of leadership that such a relationship creates comes crashing down on them. And then they start doing a lot of barking and may become aggressive. When Seth came into Buster's life after he had been the number one in his owner's life, the dog didn't like Seth at all. Seth is just a big marshmallow relative to animals, so he took this very personally. So I recommended some changes, and they've been making changes, and Buster's doing much better. Then this last email with the question. Like a lot of my clients who ask the question, I'm sure that the answer to this question was very important to Seth, but he buried it. He buried it in a list of other questions about making the switch from puppy to adult food and stuff like that. But the question was, how can a dog, or how do you know when your dog is showing you affection? And I know the reason he asked it. He asked it because Buster was one of those dogs who was constantly jumping up on people and very, very attention-seeking, and all of those behaviors had been defined as showing love. When those behaviors had to be either ignored or the dog distracted from displaying those behaviors, then there's this feeling of there's no love. Right. How will my dog know I love him? And that's the real question, right? The question isn't how will my dog show his affection to me, but how will my dog know I love him? The answer I gave Seth is the one that I give all my clients, which is, what does the dog have to do to prove to you that he or she loves you? And that is a very, very deep philosophical question. I mean, the answer to that question moves way, way beyond the realm of cats and dogs. Because the reality is, some of us are really, really needy. We need constant signals from our animals that they love us. If they are not constantly wanting to be in our laps, lying on top of our feet, whining, nudging us with their noses, licking us, bringing us toys, we think they don't love us. That's interesting, isn't it? How much does an animal have to do to prove that they love us? Or the more meaningful way to phrase that, how much does it take us? And why does it take so much? In pure pathological terms, the ideal is for the animal to feel so secure that they can relax and enjoy themselves. They can sleep. They can go off and play with their toys and have an absolute great time. They can hang with us if we're doing something that is interesting to them. But if it's not interesting to them, they can go off and sleep or amuse themselves. But sometimes that isn't enough, is it? Sometimes we want more than that. And of course, I always ask, why? What is it about ourselves that we view as so unlovable that we need that constant proof, that constant attention, even when we know that the way we define love actually means something quite different and possibly even very detrimental to the dog and to the dog's health? Why are we so needy? That's a good question. I'm going to be interested to see how Seth answers it. I do know from my clients who have stuck it out, and I also know from personal experience, that once you get past that, once you gain the confidence to realize that the dog or the cat doesn't have to constantly prove that love, that it moves the relationship onto a whole different plane. There are two examples of this that come to mind. One was a client of mine who had a very, very attention-seeking golden retriever who was in way, way over his head, and consequently the dog became aggressive. This was back in the days before email, and so I was in weekly phone contact with them. And every week when they would call, the husband would say to me, "You know, this is really killing me. I'm doing it, but it's really killing me. When am I going to get my old dog back?" And I had to tell him the truth. I said, "You're not ever going to get your old dog back, because your dog was about a hair's breadth from biting a kid in the face. You're never going to get that old dog back, because if you get that old dog back, that old dog is gone." And he knew this, but he still had trouble. And then one day, I got a phone call from him, and I didn't even recognize his voice because he was crying. They had reached a tipping point, and he was laughing, and he was crying. And I said to him, "Do you want your old dog back?" And he said, "No. I had no idea it could be this good." And what that good was, wasn't a lot of touchy-feely type stuff. It was something that transcended that. That feeling that the love and respect is there, and that it's mutual. Another example I had of this, I have had a client, wonderful woman, whose dog was so overwhelmed by her responsibilities to protect this family and all their belongings that the dog would have nightmares. And I think I mentioned before, I don't consider it anthropomorphic to say that dogs have nightmares. because they've done functional MRIs on rats in their waking hours and their sleeping hours. And they found that rats are pretty much like humans in that they sort of replay the day's events at night in their sleep. And this particular dog, and she was one of several I've seen like this, actually had symptoms that reminded me of post-traumatic stress syndrome. If something awoke her suddenly, she came out in the fight mode. The reason the owner contacted me was because the dog was sound asleep. Their cat brushed by the dog, as she did numerous times when the dog was awake, and the dog just bolted out of her sleep and nailed the cat and seriously injured the cat. So we had to make all of these changes relative to attention-seeking behavior. And the other thing we had to change was that the owner was in the habit of running every day with her dog on one of those retractable leashes, which I hate for many, many reasons I won't get into here. And the dog would be out in front of her, and she would be running. She was a competitive runner, and if you know anything about competitive runners, their time is everything to them. I told her this couldn't happen. Either she had to leave the dog at home when she went out running, or she had to put the dog on a 6-foot leash, and she couldn't run in a straight line. She had to zigzag, go back and forth across the road, run around trees, jump over hydrants, whatever she could do, speed up, slow down, so that she would passively teach the dog to pay attention to her rather than the environment, as was the case now. It was hard for her, but she did it. So what happened after a while is that the dog learned to take her cues from the owner instead of the owner always taking her cues from the dog, and the dog would run beside her loose leash. Once that happened, she could go back into her training so that she was running at full speed. One day I got an email from her, and it started out very apologetic because she thought she was going to ask me a really stupid question and didn't want to embarrass herself, but she was really curious. That particular morning, she had been out running with the dog, and she had gotten into that euphoric mental state known as the zone. This had happened to her many times before, but on that particular day, she realized that she wasn't in the zone alone. The dog was in there with her. And she wanted to know if I thought that was stupid. And of course I didn't. Because the human-animal bond is a physiological and mental reality. It is a body-mind phenomenon. And because dogs have evolved for thousands of years to take their physiological and behavioral cues from their owners, it makes sense that the dog would be able to match his or her mental state to the owner's too. And I think that's really cool. And that's what I want for Seth, and that's what I want for a significant other, and that's what I want for Buster. But the first thing they have to come to grips with is how much overt expression of love they require and in what form to convince them that they're lovable people.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.